Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Jennifer Law, your host, joined by Cicely Marie, my co-host and producer, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello and welcome to Venus Rising. I'm Jennifer Law, and today I'm here with my co-host Cicely Marie and our research assistant Callie Fell. Today we have the pleasure of speaking with my really good friend Gary Powell, who's talking to us via Skype, and Gary is actually in England, and he's been campaigning alongside of me for years now to oppose surrogacy. By way of a proper biographical introduction, Gary is a conservative political activist in the United Kingdom, and he's a longstanding advocate for gay and lesbian equality. A really cool fact for geeks like me is that Gary was tutored in philosophy by the Right Honorable Baroness Mary Warnock. I love the titles that you in the United Kingdom give to people. And Baroness Warnock was a specialist in reproductive ethics whose inquiry led to the United Kingdom's Human Fertilization and Embryology Act of 1990. He is an original signatory of the Stop Surrogacy Now campaign and argues for a ban on all forms of surrogacy. Gary, it's sort of late in the evening there for you now in England, but we're really glad that you're taking the time to be with us. So welcome to Venus Rising.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you. Gary, tell me, what was it like to be tutored by Baroness Warnock?
Oh, it was a marvelous experience. I mean, she was a very inspirational tutor and philosopher. And it was quite a privilege to have someone like her as a tutor. So I remember working particularly hard on my essay assignments to make sure that I had something of worth and value to say to her during tutorials. And she was a very open-minded intellectual. Really wanted to get to the core of problems, very concerned about ethical issues. And as was mentioned in the introduction, that was a time in the early 80s when she was thinking very hard about assisted reproduction and surrogacy related issues.
Kind of well before the time of now where, you know, we're pushing so hard to have awareness of these issues. And she was well ahead of that.
Absolutely. And in fact, there was a certain kind of prescience going on during one tutorial when we started talking about surrogacy. And of course, I had no idea at that point that I was going to become so involved in the campaign to abolish surrogacy a number of years in the future. And she was telling me, as a result of her studies and her inquiry, that she was very strongly opposed to commercial surrogacy. And she had a more liberal attitude towards what we term as altruistic surrogacy, something I always put in quotation marks. But she was certainly implacably opposed at that time to commercial surrogacy. And she remained opposed to it right up until she recently passed away, very sadly.
Yeah, we are so sorry to hear about that. I'm sure that was an incredible loss for you and something very difficult, being that you guys worked so closely together.
Well, it was. I mean, I was very personally fond of her, and she was my referee for job applications as well. So she played quite an instrumental part in my career in education, and she was somebody I had for whom I had enormous respect. And a very distinguished British philosopher.
Well, and it was really important, you know, the work that she was doing at that time. You know, we're pre-recording this for our audience listeners, but just yesterday we celebrated the birthday of Louise Brown, who was born in your country, the first test tube baby. And really that set a lot of these things into motion as it relates to the UK's Human Fertilization and Embryology Act of the 1990s. Do you recall that?
Yes, I do. And that was when I started thinking particularly hard about the surrogacy issue and looking further into it. And I didn't have the in-depth knowledge about surrogacy that I started to develop after that as a result of watching your excellent documentaries, Jennifer. But that was the beginning of my path of concern about the whole issue and how surrogacy was beginning to be presented as though it were an LGBT right. And I could see that there were some very serious moral concerns about surrogacy. And because I've been a gay activist for so many years, I was particularly concerned about this industry becoming associated with the gay and lesbian rights movement.
That must not have been a very popular opinion at the time and put you in quite a predicament with people that you knew, I would assume.
Well, in a sense, it did. The strange thing is, maybe it's not so strange, that the vast majority of my gay and lesbian friends are opposed to surrogacy. And I think there are very many, and that was before I even started talking to them about the issue. And a lot of people have a visceral concern about the ethics of surrogacy and whether this is something that really should be regarded as acceptable in moral terms. However, what we've got going on is we've got a very large global gay and lesbian community, but we've also got a very small caucus of radical gay and lesbian activists, particularly younger people. And it's the radical activists who have the ear of the LGBT media, which, of course, is the center for dissemination of information to the gay and lesbian community in general. And it's these radical activists who seem to be determining the agenda. And it's getting to the point where people are being accused of being homophobic simply for expressing opposition to surrogacy. And there's a conflict here because I know from my own experience that a lot of people who aren't in the slightest homophobic and actually who are gay or lesbian themselves have very serious concerns about surrogacy. Yet on the other hand, we've got the radical LGBT media telling us that we're supposed to shout down people who oppose surrogacy under accusations of homophobia, or at least this is increasingly what is happening. So I don't believe what we're told in the LGBT media about this widespread support for surrogacy in the LGBT community. I think that there are certain people who are steering opinion, and these are the people who own the media outlets. And I think if you ask more generally and you ask people when they know they're not in fear of recriminations and accusations of homophobia being shouted down, a lot of people, even without knowing the details that we know in our campaign of how harmful surrogacy is to women and children, a lot of people have a very strong visceral hesitation about surrogacy. And certainly I don't want a process, I don't want an issue as dangerous and exploitative as surrogacy to taint the campaign for gay and lesbian equality. I mean, in my view, that's a very important movement, and it's one that will be obstructed if it becomes associated with campaigns that actually undermine the human rights of other people.
Wow, that is incredibly powerful. And that is a very different view than what we are hearing in the media. And that is something so important that we need to hear. And we need to continue spreading this message as much as possible.
Yes.
You mentioned, you know, the media and people shouting us down. You've had your share of, you know, people shouting you down, you know, specifically on Twitter and social media. You know, you at liberty to give some of the examples of some of the hate that's been, you know, shouted at you?
Well, I'm unfortunately, some of the examples aren't repeatable on air, but I always keep a copy of insults that are sent in my direction to stick into my metaphorical gallery of hurts. And just as some kind of record, a historical record of what's going on. But the interesting thing is, when people come back with insults, they don't actually address the issues. I mean, if I present opposition to surrogacy, I want to tell people why I oppose it. I'm not just trying to give myself some kind of gain some attention for myself by expressing an opinion about my opposition to surrogacy. I want to try to persuade other people to think harder about the issues. And I also want to model that it's okay to go against the flow. That if there's this community that is telling us all, this is, I'm talking about the radical LGBT community of the modern age. They're telling us all what we have to believe if we're not to be shouted down, if we're not to be insulted. I would like to model that actually it's okay to challenge these people. And it's okay to challenge these activists who tell us what we're supposed to believe without giving us adequate justification for why we should be believing that. So I present my arguments. I present the arguments about the harm caused to women and to children by the surrogacy process, the exploitation of low-income women, the fact that big fertility makes a mint out of this whole industry, the surrogacy agencies and their lawyers and their clinicians and their counselors. What I get back, though, is just vulgar abuse. You know, it's name calling, it's being called a bigot, being called a homophobe. And actually, sometimes the people who call me a homophobe don't realize that I'm gay. And that I've been campaigning for gay rights for 40 years. So that's quite, it's quite satisfying to be able to just lob that back at them after they've made those assumptions. But it's really, it's what happens is if you've got a pressure group or a section of a minority group, a very vocal and hot-headed section of a minority group that's got very strong ideas, they're not going to be open to listening to arguments. But the bystanders will hopefully be open to the arguments. All those people who haven't really thought about the issue, who haven't felt that they want to put their head above the trenches by expressing doubts, by expressing any opposition, which could lead to them being shouted down. It's just giving some kind of indication to them that it's okay to oppose, and presenting the arguments for people to digest individually without the pressure of anybody else telling them what they should and shouldn't be believing.
That's what I love about working with you and the coalition, you know, the Stop Surrogacy Now campaign, which really is a diverse group of people. I'm remembering when we all went off to Madrid, and it was you and me and Pierrette Pape, who was then with the European Women's Lobby, Julie Bindel.
Yes.
Monica Sargentini with the big Italian paper, who sort of tagged along, and of course Kelly Martinez and her husband.
Yes.
I'm just curious, as a longtime political activist in the United Kingdom, and you're actually an elected official too, what was it like doing political activism work in Spain? What were the similarities, or what did you think about that?
Do you know, Jennifer, there was something very unique about that. And it was very, very heartening, because there we were, a collection of people with very different political beliefs, very different religious beliefs or none. And yet we found a very important point of connection. And there was a great feeling of friendship and collegiality that grew up between us. And I thought, well, it was very, very fulfilling, that trip to Madrid. I felt the work that was carried out there was most fruitful. But it was great to have that sense of camaraderie with colleagues from other parts of the political spectrum, from my own and with other religious beliefs than my own. And it just shows how it's possible. If people can just set their differences on certain issues aside for a moment, it's actually possible to forge a really powerful and synergistic coalition that crosses lots of different boundaries. And that was a very energizing thing. And I think that was quite a unique experience in Spain, though it's one I've had since when we've been involved in anti-surrogacy campaign projects, including the trip to Washington DC recently to speak at the Heritage Foundation.
Right. Gary, can you tell me a little bit about that experience and your presentation that you did there? Have you had any backlash from that?
Well, I haven't had any backlash, any negative backlash. And I've had a couple of very positive emails sent from American viewers. I don't know whether they were in the audience or whether they sent the they'd watched the video online. So the feedback I've had has been positive, and I was reading through the comments underneath the YouTube publication of the video, and of course there were a few that weren't so supportive, but there were very, very many highly supportive comments, and that was most heartening.
It was really a good time. It was great to be with Melissa Farley too, and have her sort of round out the discussion with her work in prostitution. We'll need to get Melissa on the show to talk about her work.
It was a pleasure to meet Melissa, and she gave me some very good ideas as well. And this is the wonderful thing about meeting other colleagues from different parts of the political scene, that there's a great cross-fertilization of ideas. And it's such a pity that so many people in the modern age, particularly in contemporary politics, close their minds to the thoughts and reflections of people from other political perspectives. I think that a great deal is lost as a result of that.
Yeah, it's like we're afraid that new ideas are dangerous or something.
Yes. Well, of course they are. And of course the pro surrogacy, as far as the pro surrogacy activists are concerned, and as far as some of the radical LGBT activists are concerned, who are, in my view, are taking the gay and lesbian rights movement right off the rails and over the cliff. And I just hope it's not too late to stop this. But as far as they're concerned, of course, if they do open themselves to other people's ideas, they might have to change their minds. Good. And I think that's the whole problem.
You're like reading my mind here, dude. That's Melissa Farley always calls us dude. Where do you think they got off track, this radical sort of offshoot of the gay and lesbian lobby? Can you pinpoint it, or can you diagnose it? What caused it? What happened?
Well, it feels to me a bit like somebody being all dressed up but having nowhere to go, because so many gains have been made as far as legislation and social attitudes are concerned. So many gains have been made over the last couple of decades in the gay and lesbian rights movement. And we have, for all intents and purposes, achieved equality as far as legislation and as far as social attitudes are concerned. Of course, there are pockets of people who don't have such enlightened ideas. But in the West, really, we've achieved so much. But at the same time, you've got this very big industry that's developed, the gay and lesbian rights industry. In some cases, there's quite a lot of money to be made in that industry. And on top of that, you've got a lot of people who are fired up about their sexual identity and injustices that they've experienced. And I think despite the legal equality and despite the social equality that we enjoy in the West today, it's still the case that gay and lesbian people are very much isolated on the whole. And because of the way society is structured, because of the existence, the systemic occurrence of homophobia over so many hundreds of years, society hasn't changed structurally to the extent where people, gay and lesbian people, are properly integrated in a very kind of carefree and easy way. The one can live the same way one can live one's life as a heterosexual. It's still quite difficult to meet gay friends. It's pretty hit and miss. is quite difficult to meet a partner. I mean, if you're a gay male, assuming that other, say, 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 of the population is gay, how it could be a lesbian instead of a gay, it applies to both sexes. You might see somebody you like at work, and of course, there's a 1 in 20 chance of them falling into the category of people who might ever find you attractive enough to want a relationship with you just by virtue of sexual orientation. So the odds are stacked against you already. And then, of course, within that 1 in 20, it might be the case that only another 1 in 20 would find you somebody appealing to them. So you're actually really reducing the odds when it comes to being able to meet someone compatible. And it's hard enough for heterosexual people to meet compatible partners. But of course, if you're gay or lesbian, just statistically, the odds are so much harder. So this was all really to say the structural problems, that societal problems that gay and lesbian people experience are also compounded by the statistical problems of how few people are gay and lesbian in any one population. And I think a lot of gay and lesbian people are feeling really detached and alienated from their societies. I've come across it myself in online social groups, you know, a sense of a lot of people actually being quite lonely and detached, alienated. And I think there are a lot of very angry and disappointed gay and lesbian people around. Now, activism is an area that people can channel their positive energies into, and also their negative energies. And so often I get the impression in the modern age, not only in the gay and lesbian, in gay and LGBT activism, but in general, I get the impression of actually people channeling their general anger, existential anger and frustrations into a political cause. And that can lead to a really unhelpful victim mentality. And I think sometimes this victim mentality can be, for those who hold it, can be quite a negative thing for a number of gay and lesbian people to carry. I think in many senses, we have been victims, and especially more than a couple of decades ago, and we have experienced discrimination and victimization. Of course, in large parts of the world, you know, Middle East comes to mind immediately, you can be hanged or flogged, imprisoned for being gay or lesbian. So, you know, there is still a great deal of discrimination and victimization about. But as far as the West is concerned, I feel that there is a lot of kind of redirected anger compounded by the fact that we've got this LGBT industry, which is represented by the gay and lesbian charities and by the gay media. I think this seems to be the engine that is taking the gay and lesbian rights train off the rails.
Gary, I actually have a question for you. When I talk to friends, you know, in my life and talk about this subject of surrogacy and, you know, trying to find a partner and build a family, I guess something that I get asked a lot is, well, how are gay and lesbian supposed to start a family then? What's your answer to that? Or how would you guide someone with that question? And I'm always kind of at a loss for that. Of course, it's never okay to use someone else to get gain. And, you know, we don't have rights to anything or anyone else. But it's a hard family. It's a hard question. And you are sympathetic to people wanting to have family and wanting to have community. So how would you direct that answer?
Well, absolutely. And of course, I'm sympathetic to people who would like to have a child and aren't in a position to have children for any reason. And of course, when you the situation of gay male couples, there's the option of applying for adoption, of course, and as well as the option to consider surrogacy. And that, of course, is the option that I work to try to discourage. A number of gay, I have to say from the outset that I'm not opposed to parenting by gay and lesbian couples. And I've seen examples amongst friends of excellent parenting where they've adopted children who've been in local authority care. And I've actually seen the lives of those children transform. That is one option. Of course, some people have children from a previous heterosexual relationship that they bring up in their new same-sex relationship. That seems to happen quite a lot as well. The whole question is there a universal human right to be a parent? And I don't think there is. And of course, I think all of us will be able to think of examples of parents who really shouldn't have had children because they are such bad parents. So that's just an example of why the proposal that there's a universal human right to have children is one that needs to be subjected to scrutiny. I think if people start to go down the road of thinking that commercial surrogacy is acceptable for gay couples, so that they have the same equality in terms of having children as heterosexual couples, they have to think hard about who benefits and who is disadvantaged by the surrogacy procedure. Firstly, I don't know of any gay or lesbian right or any claim to a gay and lesbian right that excludes the majority of people. The only people who can access commercial surrogacy are the very wealthy. I mean, you're almost inevitably talking about six-figure sums. And for most people, that is just inaccessible. So those people who regard surrogacy as a gay right are advocating something that would be a right only for the very wealthy. And that would be very peculiar in the gay rights canon to have a right of that kind. Secondly, I don't know of any other right, any other claim to rights in the gay and lesbian rights movement or any other legitimate claim that would involve undermining the rights of other groups. So the claimed right to have children via surrogacy would be at the expense of the low-income women who are often pressured by economic circumstances to involve themselves in the surrogacy process, and also the babies who are born as a result of that process, who can suffer medical difficulties and also genealogical bewilderment at some point later on, wanting to know who their biological parents are, but being prevented by the law from finding out. So as far as I'm concerned, no legitimate gay or lesbian right can be a right that comes at the expense of the right of another group, such as of women and of children.
And just so our audience listeners are clear, Gary is part of the Stop Surrogacy Now campaign. We oppose all surrogacy for everybody. While we're talking about Gary's particular point of view as a gay activist and the rights of gays and lesbians to access surrogacy applies to all human beings. Right, Gary?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, this is one of the counts on which I've been accused of homophobia, actually, because I spend so much time talking about surrogacy in the gay community. But the only reason I do that is because I'm a gay activist, and I have been for 4 decades. And because this is my area of specialization and experience, this is the area where I feel I'm most likely to be able to make a positive impact. So, of course, I'm opposed to surrogacy in all circumstances by both heterosexual and gay couples. So that absolutely does merit clarification. But it does happen fairly frequently that people get back to me and they say, well, look, it's not only gay people who are having children via surrogacy. The majority of intended parents are heterosexual, and that's absolutely right. So I wouldn't want to give the impression that I'm saying no to surrogacy for the gay community and yes to surrogacy to the heterosexual community, because that wouldn't be the case. I'm saying no to surrogacy to everybody, not only no to commercial surrogacy, which is the worst form, but no to so-called altruistic surrogacy as well, where people, which is legal in the UK, commercial surrogacy is banned under the 1985 Surrogacy Arrangements Act. But so-called altruistic surrogacy isn't banned. And so people can volunteer to be gestational mothers for other people. And the law allows them to receive what are called reasonable expenses. Now, reasonable expenses are not defined in law. And I've heard of sums going as high as £20,000 being paid to the birth mother as reasonable expenses. And on top of that, in the UK, a surrogate mother, gestational surrogate mother, is entitled to 6 weeks paid maternity leave from her company or employer at 90% of her salary. And after that, 39 weeks of paid maternity leave at a much lower rate. It's about £150-160 a week. But if you add it all up, a birth mother entering into so-called altruistic surrogacy arrangements receives £20,000 as a legitimate expense payment, reasonable expense payment as defined in law, and then say another £5,000 from their employer or in terms of maternity leave. Then they're being paid £25,000 for their surrogacy services. And we should also remember that once the baby is snatched away from her, she will have no baby to look after. So, but still have an entitlement of a year's maternity leave with the maternity payments, which is something quite bizarre, I think.
Yeah. Carrie, thank you so much for being on Venus Rising today. You have really given us a lot to share with our listeners and hopefully encourage our listeners to think, because that's really what we're here for. We are here to not persuade anyone and not to force anyone, but to really encourage people to think outside of what the media is saying. So thank you so much for being here.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me onto the podcast.
Of course, you are welcome anytime. And to all of our listeners, thank you so much for joining us this week with Gary Powell. We encourage you to listen to the rest of our podcast episodes on Podomatic. You can also find links to them on our company website, which is cdc-network.org. So thank you from all of us at Venus Rising, where we are always encouraging you to think beyond the masses.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising with Jennifer and Cicely. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.